Part 6. In modern parlance, when we begin a process of rigorous logical reasoning, it is customary to characterize the elements with which we begin as fundamental assumptions. This has replaced the old Greek conception of beginning a process with axioms, which were viewed as self-evident truths. But our substitution of the word assumption grows out of the fact that the question as to whether a statement is true or not is not a problem capable for logic by itself to determine. Logic would determine only that which follows from a group of preliminary statements, and the question as to whether those statements are true or not is extra-logical, ultimately. In using the term assumption, therefore, it is not implied that the terms are necessarily false or unknown or untrue, but simply that for the process that starts at that point, they are simply given, and the question of their truth is not considered. What is of importance is that which is implied by them. Now, the material of these given assumptions may be simply fanciful inventions. They may be the result of judgments based upon experience, or they may be transcriptions from the level of realization. But in either case, or in any of these cases, for the purposes of logical reason, they're viewed as assumption, by which is meant that their truth or untruth is not here considered, but only the consequences that follow from them. Using the word assumption in the sense just expounded, it is a fundamental assumption of these discourses, and as well of all my writings, lectures, and other tapes since 1936, that realization gives truth, spelt with a capital T, that it is authoritative on its level, but that in the process of transcription of this pure material, which is non-conceptual in its original form, into a conceptual statement, distortion can arise, and that therefore, if we have a material that comes or purports to come from the level of realization, enlightenment, or mystical unfolding, that gives results in the field of discourse that seem to be incompatible, then we should look for a possible error in the transcription. And second, even though there is no error detectable by reason of the transcription, there is the further assumption, which again is grounded upon experience, or rather, empirics, that there is difference of level in the case of different realizations, and that realizations upon a lower level, which may appear to be incompatible, can be, and as a matter of fact, have been resolved by an ascension to a higher level of realization, from which perspective the apparent incompatibility of lower level realization is resolved. Therefore, in statements that may appear, and in fact do appear, among the great religious philosophies of the world, our first effort should be not to view them as essentially incompatible, that one may be false while another true, but rather to see if from some deeper or higher perspective they may not be shown as complements of each other. We have so far considered, either in these discourses or elsewhere among my writings or statements, three different forms of apparent incompatibility. First, and primarily here in these discourses, we considered the contrast between the universal illusionism of Sri Shankaracharya and the universal realism of Sri Aurobindo, and have offered a suggestion for the resolution of this apparent incompatibility. Elsewhere, I have considered the apparent incompatibility between the anatmic doctrine of the great Buddha and the atma-vidya of Sri Shankaracharya. To put in simpler terms, it is the doctrine in one case that there is no permanent self, and in the other case, that the Atman is permanent if taken in a sufficiently profound sense. We have also considered the contrast between the positivistic position of the Buddhistic sutras and the substantialistic position which is presented in the Vedanta philosophies of both Shankaracharya and Sri Aurobindo. We have now to face a fourth apparent incompatibility. The Buddhistic position is radically non-theistic. It therefore contrasts with the three following possible forms: the extra cosmic theism of the Ben Israel religions, namely Judaism, Christianity, and Muslimism, also with pure pantheism, and finally with a combination of pantheism plus transcendentalism, which is characteristic of the standpoint of Sri Aurobindo. I'll present this contrast by a quotation from Sri Aurobindo on the one hand, and a quotation from one known to many of us as Kuthumi from the Mahatma letter, where he speaks explicitly as a philosopher and a Buddhist. The quotation taken from Aurobindo is to be found in the Life Divine, beginning at the bottom of page 317, and consisting of two paragraphs which conclude at the bottom of page 319. Quoting, "But it is evident that whatever the posture taken or relation formed in any individual notice of Purusha Prakriti, the being is in a fundamental cosmic relation, lord or ruler, of his nature. For even when it allows nature to have its own way with it, its consent is necessary to support her workings. This comes out in its fullest revelation in the third aspect of the reality, the divine being who is the master and creator of the universe. Here the Supreme Person, the being in its transcendental and cosmic consciousness and force, comes to the front, omnipotent, omniscient, the controller of all energies, the conscious in all that is conscient or inconscient, the inhabitant of all souls and minds and hearts and bodies, the ruler or overruler of all works, the enjoyer of all delight, the creator who has built all things in his own being, the all-person of whom all beings are personalities, the power from whom are all powers, the self, the spirit in all, by his being the father of all that is, in his consciousness force, the divine mother, the friend of all creatures, the all blissful, the all beautiful, of whom beauty and joy are the revelation, the all beloved, and the all-lover." In a certain sense, so seen and understood, this becomes the most comprehensive of the aspects of the reality, since here all are united in a single formulation. For the Ishvara is supra-cosmic as well as intra-cosmic. He is that which exceeds and inhabits and supports all individuality. He is the supreme and universal Brahman, the Absolute, the Supreme Self, the Supreme Purusha. But very clearly, this is not the personal God of popular religions, a being limited by his qualities, individual and separate from all others. For all such personal gods are only limited representations or names and divine personalities of the one Ishvara. Neither is this the Saguna Brahman, active and possessed of qualities, for that is only one side of the being of the Ishvara. The Nirguna, immobile and without qualities, is another aspect of his existence. Ishvara is Brahman, the reality, self, spirit, revealed as possessor, enjoyer of his own self-existence, creator of the universe and one with it, pantheos, and yet superior to it, the eternal, the infinite, the ineffable, the divine transcendence. The sharp opposition made between personality and impersonality by our mental way of thinking is a creation of the mind based on the appearances of the material world. For here in terrestrial existence, the inconscient from which everything takes its origin appears as something entirely impersonal. Nature, the inconscient energy, is entirely impersonal in her manifest essence and dealings. All forces wear this mask of impersonality. All qualities and powers, love and delight, and consciousness itself have this aspect. Personality makes its apparition as a creation of consciousness in an impersonal world. It is a limitation by a restricted formation of powers, qualities, habitual forces of nature action, an imprisonment in a limited circle of self-experience which we have to transcend. To lose personality is necessary if we are to gain universality. Still more necessary if we are to rise into the transcendence. But what we thus call personality is only a formation of superficial consciousness. Behind it is the person, who takes on various personalities, who can have at the same time many personalities, but is himself one, real, eternal. If we look at things from a larger point of view, we might say that what is impersonal is only a power of a person. Existence itself has no meaning without an existent. Consciousness has no standing place if there is none who is conscious. Delight is useless and invalid without an enjoyer. Love can have no foundation or fulfillment if there is no lover. All power must be otios if there is not an almighty. For what we mean by person is conscious being. Even if this emerges here as a term or product of the inconscient, it is not that in reality. For it is the inconscient itself that is a term of the secret consciousness. What emerges is greater than that in which it emerges, as mind is greater than matter, soul than mind, spirit most secret of all, the supreme emergence, the last revelation, is the greatest of all. and spirit is the Purusha, the all-person, the omnipresent conscious being. It is the mind's ignorance of this true person in us, its confusion of person with our experience of ego and limited personality, the misleading phenomenon of the emergence of limited consciousness and personality in an inconscient existence that have made us create an opposition between these two aspects of the reality. But in truth, there is no opposition. An eternal, infinite self-existence is the supreme reality. But the supreme transcendent eternal being, self and spirit, an infinite person, we may say, because his being is the essence and source of all personality, is the reality and meaning of the self-existence. So too, the cosmic self, spirit, being, person, is the reality and meaning of cosmic existence. The same self, spirit, being, or person, manifesting its multiplicity, is the reality and meaning of individual existence. The end of the quotation. The primary fact which is indicated by this quotation is that in the philosophy of Sri Aurobindo, the conception of an infinite being who is a person, of whom one would speak using a capitalized personal pronoun he, is the ultimate principle of all. It is also stated that this conception of person, spelt with a capital P, is not the same as our ordinary conception of person, and this results in a real obscurity in the whole philosophy of Sri Aurobindo. At any rate, this much seems clear, that the concept of an infinite ultimate person implies that a conscious attitude can be taken by this supremacy towards the individual, particularly the individual sadhaka, that it is a being who is conscious. It is not a case of a root consciousness or a root matter in the sense of a sabbhavat, that is the element, but a supreme person. And this supreme person is identified with the concept of Ishvara. Ordinarily, we view the Parabrahma as the supreme in its nirguna aspect, and the Ishvara as its personalized manifestation. At least this is characteristic of the other Indian philosophies with which I am acquainted. Thus here the Ishvara is seen as supreme, and that should be borne in mind when considering the quotation I am about to make from the writing of Kuthumi in the Mahatma letters. This quotation will consist of the first paragraph of letter number 10, which appears on page 52 of the Mahatma letters. And under the heading are these words: Notes by K.H. on a preliminary chapter headed God by Hume, intended to preface an exposition of occult philosophy. The quotation is as follows: Neither our philosophy nor ourselves believe in a God, least of all in one whose pronoun necessitates a capital H. Our philosophy falls under the definition of Hobbes. It is preeminently the science of effects by their causes, and of causes by their effects. And since it is also the science of things deduced from first principle, as Bacon defines it, before we admit any such principle, we must know it, and have no right to admit even its possibility. Your whole explanation is based upon one solitary admission made simply for argument's sake in October last. You were told that our knowledge was limited to this, our solar system. Ergo, as philosophers who desired to remain worthy of the name, we could not either deny or affirm the existence of what you termed a supreme, omnipotent, intelligent being of some sort beyond the limits of that solar system. But if such an existence is not absolutely impossible, yet unless the uniformity of nature's law breaks at those limits, we maintain that it is highly improbable. Nevertheless, we deny most emphatically the position of agnosticism in this direction. And as regards the solar system, our doctrine knows no compromises. It either affirms or denies, for it never teaches but that which it knows to be the truth. Therefore, we deny God both as philosophers and as Buddhists. We know there are planetary and other spiritual lives, and we know there is in our system no such thing as God, either personal or impersonal. Parabrahma is not a God, but absolute, immutable law. And Ishvara is the effect of avidya and maya, ignorance based upon the great delusion. The word God was invented to designate the unknown cause of those effects which man has either admired or dreaded without understanding them. And since we claim, and that we are able to prove what we claim, namely, the knowledge of that cause and causes, we are in a position to maintain there is no God or gods behind them. End of quotation. Could any two philosophies stand in more radical contrast than these two as represented by the quotations just given. It would seem that they hit head on, that the difference between them is more than a paradox which can be resolved by the ascending to some more comprehensive or synthetic point of view. In other words, it appears that we are in the presence of a real contradiction, where one must make a choice and cannot accept both positions at the same time. I am rather saddened to have to admit this. I would wish that it were otherwise. But here is an issue that forces one to choose. Either the root of all is being in the sense of person, which is just another name for God, or the root of being is a principle quite impersonal, and the concept of person belongs exclusively to a lower category. Thus, in the latter case, personality would be an achievement in the evolution and not an original fact, something eternal and even infinite. And in fact, consonant with all of our common understanding of the word person, an infinite person is a contradiction in terms. Of course, this may be a verbal distinction only. It may be that Aurobindo has taken the word person to extend it illegitimately beyond its proper usage, as earlier he has pointed out, has been necessary in the use of words like intuition and consciousness, and that must be borne in mind. But as stated, there is here a clash of two positions such that no responsible thinker can accept both positions at the same time. Now, which way on this point must I take my own stand? Here I must be governed by the body of realizations that I have known, and none of them confirm the principle of person. I direct your attention to the realization designated as the high indifference. Three aspects stood out in this. First of all, the principle of equilibrium, a state of complete balance, as between all pairs of opposites. It thus was, as the second point, the integration of all pairs of opposites whatsoever, even of that ultimate pair of opposites represented as samsara, the universe of objects, or the evolution on one side, and that other state known variously as nirvana or moksha. The one, namely the samsara, was the field of duality and ultimately of manyness. Nirvana carried the force of unity, of the essential oneness of all. And thus, the contrast of samsara, the universe of objects, or the evolution, with nirvana, is the ultimate duality, the duality of the many and the one. But the high indifference was the integration of these two. Finally, it contained the meaning of an ultimate consciousness which was self-existent and not a function of a being, but on the contrary, inverted the relationship so that all beings and all selves were seen as functions of a self-existent consciousness, which was the universal support of all. There was also the indication of a greater beyond, an intimation. So I do not regard this as the final possible word, but simply as the monitor or modulus of any statement for which I am responsible. Let us return to the quotation from Sri Aurobindo and examine what appears to be a critical sentence in that quotation. This occurs on page 319. Quoting, "If we look at things from a larger point of view, we might say that what is impersonal is only a power of the person. Existence itself has no meaning without an existent. Consciousness has no standing place if there is none who is conscious. Delight is useless and invalid without an enjoyer. Love can have no foundation or fulfillment if there is no lover. All power must be otios if there is not an almighty." End of quotation. Let us examine this in some detail. Take the phrase, we might say that what is impersonal is only a power of the person. And consider in connection with this a clause from the quotation on page 410. The creations of the absolutely real should be real and not illusions. Why not then? The application of that principle here. It would seem that the expressions of the power of the person would be like unto its source by the same criterion, and therefore that expression would be personal. Now we have in the balance of this sentence about four statements that are important for our consideration. First, the statement that existence implies an existent, that consciousness implies one who is conscious, that delight implies an enjoyer, that love implies a lover, and that power implies an almighty. In other words, entity is here viewed as the foundation, and that all four of these, existence, consciousness, delight, love, and power, are the expressions of an underlying entity. This, then, is characteristic of substantialistic philosophical thinking. And I admit that to our ordinary experience, this seems reasonable enough and is what we might very well expect to be the case. But let us look at the analysis of Buddha with respect to fire. In connection with the question, is the qualities of fire, namely light and heat, functions of an underlying substance? To this, the answer of the Buddha was no, that the qualities, light and heat, are all that there is of fire. And there is no basis for assuming an unseen, hidden substance. As I pointed out at the time, this is characteristic of what is technically known as positivistic thinking. Now, by the same token, by the same method, it would be inferred that he would apply the same technique here, that existence is a fact of immediate experience, and that we do not have a basis of affirming an existent behind the existence. And in the same way, with respect to consciousness, the entity who is in conscious is an assumption, a substantive something behind that carries the consciousness. Whereas what we know is simply the fact of consciousness, and that rests on itself alone. The same with delight, the same with love, and the same with power. So here we have presented before us in very strong form two ways of viewing the world. The phenomenalistic, positivistic position formulated by the Buddha, and the substantialistic formulation of Sri Aurobindo. Now for myself, I will admit that prior to that realization of the high indifference, I could not have imagined any other way. I could not have imagined a consciousness that was not a consciousness of a self. I would have felt that the center, which is conscious, was the starting point. And it was only the impact of the realization of the high indifference that rendered it possible for me to see otherwise. Now let us consider a statement of Dr. Carl G. Jung in connection with this same question. I direct your attention to the psychological commentary of Dr. Carl G. Jung, prefacing the Book of the Great Liberation, edited by Evans Wentz, and which is based upon the teachings of Padma Sambhava. Quoting from page 38 in Roman numerals, paragraph toward the bottom of the page, the last sentence of the preceding paragraph had this phrase: the self-liberating power of the introverted mind. Continuing, this aspect of the mind is practically unknown to the West, though it forms the most important component of the unconscious. Many people flatly deny the existence of the unconscious, or else they say that it consists merely of instincts or of repressed or forgotten contents that were once part of the conscious mind. It is safe to assume that what the East calls mind has more to do with our unconscious than with mind as we understand it, which is more or less identical with consciousness. To us, consciousness is inconceivable without an ego. It is equated with the relation of contents to an ego. If there is no ego, there is no body to be conscious of anything. The ego is therefore indispensable to the conscious process. The Eastern mind, however, has no difficulty in conceiving of a consciousness without an ego. Consciousness is deemed capable of transcending its ego condition. Indeed, in its higher form, the ego disappears altogether. Such an ego-less mental condition can only be unconscious to us, for the simple reason that there would be nobody to witness it. I do not doubt the existence of mental states transcending consciousness, but they lose their consciousness to exactly the same degree that they transcend consciousness. I cannot imagine a conscious mental state that does not refer to a subject, that is, to an ego. Note that sentence particularly. The ego may be depotentiated, divested, for instance, of its awareness of the body. But so long as there is awareness of something, there must be somebody who is aware. The unconscious, however, is a mental condition of which no ego is aware. It is only mediately and by indirect means that we eventually become conscious of the existence of an unconscious. We can observe the manifestation of unconscious fragments of the personality detached from the patient's consciousness in insanity. But there is no evidence that the unconscious contents are related to an unconscious center analogous to the ego. There are good reasons why such a center is not even probable. End of the quotation. Now, here we have presented again the same difficulty of which Aurobindo spoke when he said that there cannot be a consciousness if there is none who is conscious. But here is a position that is taken in Dr. Jung's case with relation to a more ancient Indian figure, namely Padma Sambhava. And there is presented quite evident the conception of an ego-less or self-less, and therefore inevitably a person-less consciousness. It implies the existence of consciousness as a part from any center. The difficulty that Jung brings up is a difficulty of imagination. He cannot imagine, he says. And I recognize very well this difficulty. But then he goes on to say that in the unconscious there is a psychical condition in which there is no evidence of a center analogous to that of an ego. And even further, that there's good reason to believe that such a center is impossible. Now then, if by the unconscious, in the psychological sense, we mean the same thing that the Tibetan Buddhist is speaking of when he uses the term Rigpa as that pure form of consciousness which is not cognizant of object, then here we have the idea of a reversal or transformation in consciousness, such that that which through our ordinary consciousness, namely the relative consciousness of which Jung is speaking, is inverted, and that which previously seemed unconscious to the inverted state is consciousness. But now, a consciousness that does not depend upon a center for its existence. Now, I'm well aware that using consciousness in these two senses of our ordinary relative consciousness and of a deeper kind of consciousness, namely that which is called Rigpa, is straining the use of a term illegitimately, as Sri Aurobindo said in a footnote that I quoted in another connection. But we have no other terms. It is a different kind of consciousness. But it is awareness that I can say positively. Now, even though we cannot imagine a consciousness which does not have a center, or which is not the consciousness of a self, it does not therefore follow that we cannot conceive of such a state. This is assumed in the development of the aphorisms on consciousness without an object and in the work, The Philosophy of Consciousness Without an Object. For this consciousness is a consciousness also without a self. We can conceive of it, for this is a practice with which we are familiar in higher mathematics, where at certain levels we deal with material that cannot be imagined and has none of the aid of intuition. Yet progress can be made in the field. Thought can be accomplished, results attained that are valuable not only for pure mathematics, but even in the field of practical application. Therefore, I have assumed in the writing of The Philosophy of Consciousness Without an Object that the reader can take this position and then judge the consequences that follow from it. The consequences ultimately may lead to an orientation that solves the metaphysical problem for the individual that would bring about an adjustment between the seeking individual and the world, the universe, the transcendent beyond him, that we may say is seeking a pragmatic test of value. We have now dealt with a principle or problem of contrast between two points of view that seem quite incompatible to us. I shall continue with further implications in the part that follows this present discussion. This, therefore, is the end of Part 6